always looked at the meta level, and I started that at Oracle Corporation. That was one of the big things that really gave me a lot of insight, is that don't get stuck in today's technology. Look at the idea of, well, how do you do process? How are people always going to be like the people that they are? How do you get teams motivated? How do you keep them motivated? You know, how do you make sure that you're working on the right things? That hasn't changed at all.
You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
So I'm absolutely delighted today to have David Moss with me. David, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
So David is a career technologist. You're a musician, a producer, a leadership coach, an investor, a strategic innovator with an outstanding track record of successful startups across multiple industries. I'm thinking about your medical background. Sorry.
There are a few injuries in there as well.
So. I read that you were going for med school, and I sort of obviously had this sort of, you know, medical injuries sort of fixation.
There you go. Yes. So that was one of the things that I attempted to do, possibly to please my family, and it didn't please me as much as I thought. So,
well, med school is an incredible endeavor, isn't it? Just this, talk about the Everest of academia.
It's science. If you take the medical college boards or the MCAT to get in,
yes.
It's not like the law school test or anything like that, where you're testing general knowledge. You're actually going through and testing your physics, chemistry, biology, mathematics capability, and not just your potential, but your actual capability. How well do you know, organic chemistry, et cetera? And so that alone is an 8-hour, fairly grueling test. And that's at the tip of the iceberg for what you need to be able to do. So it's an amazing thing.
And it's funny, I was talking to someone relatively recently who wouldn't let go of his argument that medicine is actually physics. It's not biology, it's not chemistry, it's physics. So, I mean, I think I ran out of arguments after a couple of minutes, actually, but...
Well, I don't know. I would guess that I would say that it's almost more psychology than anything else. I come from, my father's a psychiatrist.
And yes.
So a lot of that, if you look at psychosomatic origins of illness, there's a lot more in there. And you can say it's physics, but maybe down at the atomic level,
yes.
your mood affects your atomic level. Sure, that makes sense.
It's funny, and that is such a common thread, the idea that that we are actually completely in control of ourselves. Yeah. If you feel like getting better, miraculous. I mean, that's an entirely different topic.
It's another topic for another time, and maybe just a great talk that we can have. But I think that the basic idea is that there are so many different ways of looking at how you maintain health and psychological health, and that kind of segues into what I do, which is
yes.
really on the team side. You know, figuring out how you not just go individually, like the previous talk that you know, I just listened to your podcast, the previous one.
We're yes.
talking about individual motivation and relaxation and getting people into the zone. That's nice for an individual, but there's a bigger thing here with startups. And that's really, I guess I would say Exceed.team is really a startup for startups. That's what we do. I've worked with so many different startups that now we're starting to figure out how do we go about codifying and predicting how successful a project or a startup's project will be. And so that's my focus.
And I guess a lot of the information that you base those predictions on is going to be completely outside the dynamics of the business itself. And is it more about the individuals and the people that are driving that business?
It's a combination. Typically the founders of companies, and I've been a founder, and I've worked for a lot more founders than I've been a founder of companies. But what I find is the founders are purpose-driven, very focused, I would say fanatical, but basically they have Kool-Aid they wish you to drink.
Yes.
And they don't even need to drink the Kool-Aid. They're pouring it out by the gallon. So they have a singular focus on doing those things, but they don't necessarily know how to lead other people to exchange and share that dynamic. And that's usually the first barrier.
And I think that is a major challenge. So you're coming in as a chief technology officer, as a seasoned, experienced, incredibly capable person. You then are coming into a company where you have a founder who clearly has drive and determination on a planetary scale. But there must be tension between you saying, okay, I like your idea, but we're going to have to slightly pivot, or what sort of tensions do you get?
Well, yes. And that's a great question. One of the big things that happens is that founders usually have, even though they have singular focus, they also want to boil the ocean. And that's one of the things that typically happens, is they're looking to try to solve every possible problem in front of them. And so that's usually where the tension lies. And every CEO that I've worked with usually has a large list. An example of one very successful company that I worked with, Edmunds.com, there was a 300 plus project list. Imagine 300 projects. And this is with a 7-person part-time team, and all these things needed to get done. And so it's about focus.
And you're right. So if we go back to Edmunds.com, so that was pretty much right at the beginning of the mass adoption of the internet. So the Edmunds.com site, which is a hugely successful, it's a motor vehicle trading site.
It's a combination of automotive information. And that was the original idea, was to publish automotive information and then to provide that audience with information on things that they may wish to purchase, cars, insurance, et cetera. And that was what the business model was. But it was, at the time that I was there, we got it up to be one of the top 100 sites on the internet.
But the challenge there, because you're in uncharted territory.
Yes.
And B, you're having to really create the rules as you go along to a certain extent. So that must have been a massive challenge.
Yes. And one of the big things that we did, and this is what I do in general, and this is something that goes back to when I worked for Oracle Corporation, but the idea is to figure out what the criteria are for the selection of the things that you need to work on. So let's say you start with 300 things that you all say are the highest priority and all of them need to be done right now.
Yep.
Now you need to figure out, well, what are the weights? The way that we do that is we come up with it's almost like a game. You get 100 points, you pick 10 things out of a list of bigger things, and maybe you can come up with your own. Say, does this add to revenue? Does this make a difference to our competitors? Is this something that it would basically be a killer app or whatever? There's different criteria. Then you weight those on that scale. You get 100 points, you say 15 points to increase this revenue, 10 points to this. Then you run all of the products and features through that list, and you get a point scale from 100 down to 0, and suddenly you find out, based on our criteria at our company and what we feel is important, it turns out that these 300 projects are really 80 projects. And of those, there's only 20 that are in the 90th percentile, 90, get a score of 90 or above. Now you can start focusing on those projects, because everybody has agreed that those are the ones. And then you look at what's called weighted shorted tasks first. And so that is the thing I've used over and over again. It works every time.
Yes. And again, so this is, I was reading a book, How Google Works, which is a fascinating book. And it's exactly that same process of saying that this is the Pareto rule, the 80-20 rule.
Yes.
Where if we focus on the 20% that gives us the 80% productivity.
Exactly. And I think that one of the things that happens is that people don't do this, and they instead continually work on features, not products, and they don't move the needle.
And that is a common problem, not just with technology companies, but with any companies that are founder-driven, where they have their face so close to the coalface, as it were, and the ability to look at tasks and say, on a day-to-day basis, what are the tasks that are actually going to drive me forwards today? Is that something you teach?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. It's not only something that we teach, but it's also something that we can bring into an organization. And we're actually, what I found is, when I talked about being a startup for startups, there's a combination of things. There's the psychological, team teaching, instructional part, and then there's the analytical part, because you can actually know how well. You talked about Google. Google has some very important work that they've done in the last 3 to 5 years, looking at what they call psychological safety.
Yes.
And then the idea of measuring psychological safety in the workplace anonymously, that's what one of the things that our team is working on specifically is to bring those tools into the workplace. So as you go, you can find out predictively how well on any given day your team is actually doing, because most of the time, if they don't feel safe, they won't tell you.
And this is all about innovation.
Yes.
Because in order to drive your company forwards, it's a process of continual innovation rather than just product tweaking. So for a team to be able to feel safe that they can come up with what could be crazy ideas, but you never know, one of those crazy ideas could be the, you know, the next iPhone.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's where those ideas come from. And I think that it's that safety, exactly as you said.
And is there a culture, do you think, where you have in a startup, so let's say we take a tech startup, you have the tensions between the founder who has the vision, the team that he brings in to try and execute that vision. And we have the also the tension with the finance side
the board. Yeah.
You know, so we have the board who may or may not share. Obviously, they share the vision. But so do you find that you as the CTO, do you end up being in the middle of that sort of, you know, push and pull game?
Always. As a matter of fact, that's my role. And that is the role of CTOs. And that's, again, what we do at Exceed. But yes, the goal is that, and the way that I've described this to people is that someone needs to know the quality, effectiveness, and completeness of the work. They have a moral obligation to do that. That's typically the CTO's role, because the founders and the board typically do not understand what's being built, whether or not it's that there's quality, effectiveness, and completeness of the work. And so the person sitting in the middle, the CTO, needs to know that from the engineers, from the product designers, from the CEO, and from the board. And they have to sit in the middle and be the honest truth of where things really are. And that's a real that's a very difficult role, because in many cases it can end up, you know, if you do not understand what you're being given as a CTO, then you can give guidance to the board, oh, this will be done in 1 month, when it may be a year.
Yeah, and I think that's the role of the CTO is very misunderstood. I think it is very much the general understanding of the role of the CTO is that it is a technical, it is a technical piece where, you know, the CTO is one of those guys with the headphones on, buried in code. But in fact, my experience is that the CTO is the linchpin where, particularly in a software development or a product development cycle, you avoid ending up with a series of engineering snapshots and you end up actually with a product.
Yes. Well, and that's a very good point. I say linchpin, I look at linchpin, catalyst. That person has to at first understand, let's say at a startup level, when the CTO is first there, they have to understand what needs to be built, what resources they have. And in many cases, the resources simply aren't there. So they have to go along with the idea of creating a vision that can actually be executed, a minimum viable product, an MVP. And so that is the common thread with all of these different things, is that without having that role defined, you still have to do the work. And so initially, yes, in some cases, as a CTO, I've gone and the first thing that I do is set up all of our servers.
Yeah.
On Amazon Web Services, or start writing some code, or do an architectural diagram of what things will look like, or do wireframes about what a product will look like. The idea, though, is that those are hats that the CTO wears initially.
Yes.
A good CTO, as resources are acquired and things are growing and the confidence is gotten by the board and investors are putting more money in, or revenue is coming in, then you need to hand those hats off to people who only wear that hat. Only wear a software engineer, a QA, a product designer, an iOS developer hat. But initially, the CTO has to understand all of that and figure out, again, the quality, effectiveness, and completeness of that, and sit in the middle of all of that storm. And sometimes the storm is just in your head.
Yeah, actually, that's a very good point, actually, because your background is not just as a career CTO. I mean, you've been on the other side of the fence. And did you find that when you were actually building and running your own businesses, that it felt very different being in the role of the founder, as it were? Or were you experiencing things that you'd anticipated?
Well, having been on both sides a number of times, one of the things I did a startup called Crowd Rules. It was predictive analytics. Now I think it started maybe 12 years ago, before there was really a lot of crowd things going on. There was definitely before its time. And I did use some contractors, some people that I'd known for a while. And I found that I tried to give them the role, the CTO role, and it didn't work.
Yes.
And again, so I was one of the impatient founders. Why don't you have this? I was on Sand Hill Road with a series of five meetings scheduled to go pitch. And it's like, where's the damn demo?
Yeah.
Why is the demo done?
It reminds me of that Apple, you know, the movie about Steve Jobs. You know, you've got to get this thing to talk. So did you have your own, did you create your own, what is it, a reality distortion field? Was there a David Moss reality distortion field?
Yes, there was a reality distortion field. And that was one of the things that does happen. It was very helpful for me to do that and understand, oh, this is what CEOs are telling me what they're looking for. And that helped inform me quite a bit over the last, say, 12 years about what's really important in building out that MVP and how crucial it is to really understand what needs to be done and how fast resources can really work, because it does still require humans. This is something that, we talk about, AI and all sorts of other wonderful things. Software is still built by humans and will continue to be built by humans for quite some time.
Yes. And I think if you talk about, we've been talking about startups, but everything that you've experienced and the processes that you've built are just as relevant for companies that are developed, as it were, because innovation is just as critical throughout every stage of a business's life cycle as it is at the beginning.
Yes. And that's the very good point, is that we look at this as a team. We look at this as startups do have certain characteristics. In some cases, they're not even ready. I was in a startup very recently that I consulted for, and at some point, you have to make the determination: are you even ready to take on process and organization and look for the future? They weren't. They were literally looking at what do we need to do today so this customer doesn't walk, and that's a problem. So for your question was larger companies, it applies because innovation starts to deteriorate within a larger company when you start making things unsafe. You don't let people take chances. That's exactly what Google found in their big study, the 180 team study that they did, was that things were deteriorating even within an organization that prides itself on innovation.
And is that due to management, or is that due to the size of the company? Is there a critical mass, and once it gets beyond a certain point, it becomes impossible to innovate? Or is it just a management issue?
Well, that's a good question. I think that it's one of those things where I think that it doesn't become impossible to innovate, but it becomes harder to see how people are actually working. And the psychological safety principles really focus around, do you feel safe expressing your ideas in an unstructured environment, and do you feel like you're not going to get retaliation or have your ideas stolen or be bullied or humiliated for it? And it doesn't matter how big or small the company is, that happens. But interestingly enough, on a larger scale, when there are many more departments, it's much easier for that to happen. So people get bullied, people get put down, they shut down, they're no longer providing things, they're just basically, they're there for the paycheck.
Yes, and I think that's the real issue, isn't it? Because companies trade on their initial success, but before they know it, they've again, one of the quotes from this book, How Google Works, is what one of the employees said, that's how Google used to work. So that's that issue. So do you find that your consulting business, Exceed.team, are you more focused on startups, or are you taking all of your experience and knowledge, and is there more of a place for you in existing companies who need to have that sort of refresher, as it were?
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that happens, so first, startups, yes. Typically, startups, if they're at the right stage, they can build so that they can scale. That's one of the things that we do that really helps them out. And that's on the technology side, but also on the people side. In companies that have been around for a little while, that's actually what I've done as a CTO multiple times, is that they have, bless them, gotten a product that actually is generating revenue, and now they've got a trail of tears behind them for all of the things that they've done wrong.
Yes.
And now they need to have someone come in and try to maintain, keep people there. A lot of times you get huge groups of people leave a company, et cetera. So on a mid, from startups to any size company, this is going on right now, especially for me. The real big thing that happened was the publishing of Charles Duhigg's book about a year and a half ago. I'm trying to remember what the name of that book was. We can have a link for that.
Yes.
He's a New York Times author, and he specifically talked about Google's psychological safety program in this 180-team four-year study. But that's added extraordinary amount of awareness and need and desire for people to come in at any level to try to make teams more effective and make them feel more safe. And so it's a movement at this point. And so it happens at every level.
I agree. And this is really all about this fear of pivoting as well. So you have, coming back to early stage companies. Yeah. So an early stage company has a founder who says, this is my vision. Everyone buys into it. The funders, the finances, the VCs, the team. And then we get to a point where the vision is still there, but the business model isn't quite appropriate for the current terms. Now, what experience do you have of founders who have this fear of pivoting, this sort of, this is the way forwards, come what may? And how difficult is it to try and, is it a super tanker that you have to try and steer?
Well, it really depends on where they are in the revenue stage. If they're pre-revenue, or if they're only getting just a smattering of revenue coming in, it's much easier to get somebody to pivot if it looks like there is a possible revenue stream. If they're already have a reasonably satisfying revenue stream, but it just isn't growing, then that's a much harder to get them off of that, because it's kind of like the security blanket of that revenue coming in, and they don't want to harm it, yet it may very well be the thing that is going to kill their chances of innovating and getting past their competitors.
So do you find yourself having to protect your CEO from your funders to a certain extent,
Well, often, interestingly enough, it's usually a combination. And in a number of cases, I've worked directly with the boards. And in many cases, the way that CTO positions work nowadays, and this is something that I was one of the people that fought for it years ago, was that CTOs at one point did not report to the board. They reported to the CEO, and they really didn't get to the boardroom at all. Over the last, since Edmunds, the time, the dot-com time, CTOs got a seat in the boardroom. In that seat in the boardroom, then you're an advocate for both the CEO and for the board and for the success of the company. And so it's a very delicate balance to talk with the CEO and say, this isn't working. Here is a possible other solution. Can we try this? Can we do a pilot? Can we do a prototype? And so it's kind of a combination of working with the CEO and helping them understand, maybe look at the analytics here. We're not making any money. This is an investment. The investors aren't going to be happy. How do we do that? And how do we then translate that into a technical solution that we can do a pilot or a prototype, an MVP, to find out whether or not we can actually get revenue in a different way? And then can we take that to the board? And will the board give us, and I've done that dozens of times before, where the board has said, okay, great. We're going to free up $500,000 on this, and we're going to let you pursue this up until this point. And then, we're going to check things in 3 months and see where you are.
Okay.
And so I have to work with the CEO and the board and make sure that we really just are pretty brutal about the analytics, and make sure that if it's not working, then we figure out some way to pivot.
And if we talk about MVPs again, it's all sorts of different interpretations of what a minimum viable proposition is.
Yeah.
And so what are your views? Does one successful customer or one customer, can that constitute MVP?
Well, I think the idea is that the way that we see it from a technical perspective is it needs to be something that somebody can actually, pick up and use. And it may be very simple. It's like the microphone that you're looking at right there. You have a nice microphone set up. I have a great microphone set up here for my studio. But my microphone on my computer is what we're using right now. That's basically, it does what it needs to do. And so the idea is that as a microphone, it works just great. Can it be a better microphone? Do people need better microphones? How do we know what they're looking for in a microphone? The idea is a minimum viable product needs to start off being good enough. And this is, we used to use this term quite a bit, and I want to start reviving this. It's called good enough software. And
MVP
is about good enough. Is this good enough to put in front of somebody that they can use it and they can say, huh, well, it does this have, what if it had this, these extra little things in there? I go back to this one thing that I, a story that I heard growing up, and maybe you've heard it too, a story called Stone Soup.
No. Okay, so Stone Soup. Sounds delicious.
Okay, well, that's exactly it. Stone Soup is a group of soldiers come into a village. They're hungry. They haven't eaten for 3 days. And they bring in a pot and they start boiling water and they put stones in it. And the villagers are saying, "You haven't come and asked us for any food. What's up?" And they go, "Well, we're making stone soup." And they go, "Stone soup. It's delicious." And they do that, and they're sitting there starving and doing everything. And they come up, well, you know, "Why, can you tell us the ingredients?" "Well, it's really great, but it's even better with carrots." And over the course of another day or two, the stone soup in this big pot becomes a huge stew and all the village celebrates. That's the way I look at MVPs, is that you've got to figure out, well, what is your minimum viable product? What is your stone soup? What is the thing that it's enough to start sharing with people so that they can enjoy it and suggest how they would better use it? And in many cases, there's a great example about in your last podcast about Marshall. I think I sent you a photo with me in front of a stack of Marshalls.
Yes, yes.
Music days. So, but that was the idea, is no one intended for you know, Jimi Hendrix, you know, came out there and decided that he wanted to use Marshalls on 11 and really get some, you know, some great sounds out of them. But that wasn't the necessary intention, but that's what made it go crazy. That's what made it really work. Your audience will tell you that if you wait too long and do a waterfall methodology, which in the past I've done, you get to a certain point. It's like, we're a year and a half into this and we haven't shown it to anybody yet, but I'm sure it'll be just buffalo when we get out there. You get it out there and it's like, we don't need this. This is, it fails. You get it out there as fast as you possibly can so you can scale it and sustain it.
And I think that's absolutely right, because one of the common issues that we come across with entrepreneurs or with business at an early stage is that fear that the good enough is not good enough, that it has to be perfect. So this idea that perfection is the answer is the antithesis of success. It's the...
Yeah. I agree. Well, look at one of the things that I like to talk about is Amazon Web Services. Now, I've been using Amazon Web Services since early in 2008, maybe 2007, and they only started in 2006. And the kinds of capabilities that Amazon Web Services had back then, I remember getting a phone call in 2008 from a person at Amazon Web Services saying, "Mr. Moss, the actual physical server that's under your virtual servers is about to go down. You have 5 minutes to move your data. Please do it immediately."
Yeah, they don't get that many calls like that anymore, thankfully. But you know,
yeah, exactly. So that's an early thing about, there's a product. They put that product out. I was using that product, and it was still better than having a physical hardware and a colo. But there was a lot of stuff I had to do, and I was constantly making suggestions about how you can. Why don't you do this? Why don't you set this up? Why don't you add this? And I have continued to make suggestions over the years for Amazon Web Services that they've actually incorporated into their products.
But the assumption from everyone outside of Amazon is that Amazon spent billions of dollars perfecting this product in a lab and then launched it, and it was, you know, immediately. but the reality is that the successful companies are the companies that take action and get a product out there, get the feedback. I was talking to a company the other day that were saying that we're going to build this thing and we're going to get our suppliers in line first. And I said, "Well, have you thought about perhaps getting a customer?" No. We've got to get there. We have to perfect the product first before we can. And is that an issue that you come across
all the time? And I think that you hit on something earlier about that people want their, you know, want their product to be perfect, and it's like that everybody wants everything to look perfect and feel perfect, and that may, to a certain extent, maybe that's kind of an LA thing, or, you know, there are different people that want everything to look beautiful and perfect. The way that I look at it is that is the defining success point for me of an entrepreneur, is the willingness to get something out that solves a problem early enough. How early did you start using Facebook, for example? Back when it was an EDU, and at one point, recall, Facebook was a .edu.
I'd love to say when it was still the Facebook, but sadly, I'm a relatively, you know, not quite as early. And no, I didn't buy any shares, and I wish I'd done that.
Well, early Facebook was horrible. It crashed all the time. It had all sorts of weird things. Things were shared with people that you didn't want to have them shared with. And they just kept going out there, but they found the need. The need was is that you wanted to have some sort of thing to share. Now, the thing that we take for granted, the feed that's in Facebook right now, that's an innovation.
Absolutely. I remember that. I remember the wall and the feed. I remember those coming out and people going, this is fabulous. But
Some people said it'll never work.
I know. And some people said that the internet would never catch on, but no. So, I guess coming back to your early Oracle days, when you were there, all of these things, all these changes that we've seen really has happened in the last, 15, 17 years. So, all of these changes. And so the next question really is massive advances in technology. Are humans able to keep up? This human improvement movement, this idea that we're having to sort of retrain ourselves in the way that we think, how much of that have you come across?
Well, that's one of the things that a lot of startups and people in general, I have children, and people have asked me, in this kind of an age, how do you raise your kids as a technologist? And I say, well, it's not about mastering the technology. It's about understanding the sources of information and whether or not the sources are trusted. And so you don't necessarily have to, let's say, for example, Bitcoin, you don't necessarily have to understand how the blockchain, it works, how you put blocks in a chain, how you move things around, how there's multiple records in multiple places. You don't have to understand that at all to look at Bitcoin, have a Coinbase account and invest in Coinbase and see it go up and down and figure out whether or not you're going to lose or make money. You don't have to understand all of those things. And I think that that's one of the difficulties is that people wish to understand the intricacies of technology. And I would argue that you're never going to. What you need to do is figure out how the technology can benefit you personally, or your business, or your team, and then figure out how you would incorporate that. And does it make a difference, as positive difference, as opposed to taking away time? Early computer stuff took away a lot of money and a lot of time. And I would argue you weren't very productive. If you compare using Microsoft Word or WordPerfect or something like that years ago, you are probably less productive than you are now by a huge amount. So your question is, how do you even keep track of all the technology? It's like, well, there are a lot of really cool trends and there's all sorts of things out there, but a lot of it is be bold, give it a try. Find out whether or not it's something that works for you. But don't be such an early adopter that you're using it and proselytizing it and it ends up being the downfall of your company because it wasn't the thing that everybody got behind.
It is that, but also my point is, when you were talking earlier about psychological safety, the fact that we're now finding that there's a completely different set of demands being put on people and entrepreneurs and businesses that are trying to drive businesses forward, they need to learn different ways of thinking effectively to be able to stay innovative and to be able to keep up with this sort of massive technological charge.
So this is where we get back to the same focus that I've had is I've been through literally a dozen cycles of, well, this is the most popular language right now, or this is the most popular database, or gee, the most popular thing right now is going to be, social networks.
Yes.
And now, everybody and their dog was going to Sand Hill Road and getting money to build a social network. Now we have just a couple of dominant ones and that's it. It's going to be the same thing each time. What we've found is that no matter what, the same principles apply. You talked about my time at Oracle. I learned at Oracle that no matter what, you're still going to end up coming back to having to store your data in someplace, organize it in some way that you can gain access to it, build software in some way that people can have easy access to it, and figure out just ways of making that stuff work and figuring out how to make those decisions. So the whole idea is to meta up. Right? Yep. Go up a level, meta up, find out what specifically you need to know about the process of change, not the changes themselves. And then that's what I teach. That's what I've done at every company that I've worked with. And it's what we do at Exceed is that we work with those companies to help them understand that technological change and narrow it down so that they can, again, not boil the ocean, focus on their priorities for their company, and focus on getting a product out for their investors and for their time that exceeds the expectations, that gives a consumer or a business, you know, if it's B2C or, you know, B2B, I think the big thing coming is going to be C2C right now.
Yeah.
So as those things go out there, so that I've always looked at the meta level, and I started that at Oracle Corporation. That was one of the big things that really gave me a lot of insight, is that don't get stuck in today's technology. Look at the idea of, well, how do you do process? How are people always going to be like the people that they are? How do you get teams motivated? How do you keep them motivated? You know, how do you make sure that you're working on the right things? That hasn't changed at all.
And where you are right now in your career, is there a tipping point, or is there a fork in the roads where you're deciding, do I want to stay on this sort of one-to-one fractional CTO speaking to small groups? Or is there a yearning that you're feeling now that you have this message, now that you've been through all these different parts of the cycle, that there is a mass application for what you've learned to try and, again, operate at the meta level for all of these companies and say, if you follow these simple 10 rules, the David Moss rules, as it were, your business will be successful.
Well, exactly. And that's where I'm heading with a lot of the things that I'm doing and the things that we're doing at the company. I have a partner and several other people that are working on building those tools and figuring out how to get them out there so that they can be easily implemented, the analytics can be collected, and people can follow those basic principles. I think that I have a fairly Prezi presentation that I'm happy to share with everybody that kind of goes into 8 different areas where you can measure how ready your company is for a new idea, a product, a project, and then take that out. And the idea is just to get to a much larger group of people. I spent a lot of time, in contrast to being up at the top level on a meta level for, you know, hundreds of companies or thousands of companies or a huge audience, I have spent the last 10 years being right inside of these companies and seeing exactly what works and what doesn't work over and over again. And so I found that the rules that I've come up with and the things that I've come up with can be extrapolated to any company. And so,
I think that is absolutely critical, because we don't want people to think that this conversation is just about Silicon Valley startups who've raised $20 million in their seed round, who are creating, you know, the next Uber or the next Airbnb. What you're talking about is as applicable to a one or a two-man company as it is to a global organization.
Yeah, exactly. It's business. The way that I look at it is there's just as much business scaling as technology scaling that needs to go on. And good decisions and figuring out how to look at it from a meta level help you figure out what your priorities really are, focus on what you need to do, be efficient, get the things done that you've asked your investors, you know, for money for, and be successful. Like I said, that's the big message, and it's for technology companies. It's for it's for everybody. So,
and again, just stressing what we were talking about before, the role of the CTO is not just a technical role. It is this the hub of the wheel where all the spokes are the various different sort of divisions. You sit in the middle. So, the knowledge that you've created and what you're able to deliver with your company is not just for technology companies. It's for companies of any type. And I think those are the really valuable takeaways. That what you've learned and what you can deliver is applicable to every organization.
Hard won ground floor information, and then extrapolated up to a meta level. Yes, it's good for a lot of different types of things. And I even use some of the principles just in making general decisions in my own life and helping people do that on a personal basis as well.
And do you have that frisson of excitement right now that you have? You know, when you start a business up and you have that, wow, this is going to be great. I'm at the beginning of something massive, because I get the feeling that I think you're playing it down slightly, but this is You know, it feels like you've found the answers and now you just want to articulate it to as many people as possible.
Yes, indeed. That's where I'm heading. I hope that I'm conveying some of that, but I'm very excited about the idea that I can get out there. And I've trained a number of people on this, and I have a number of people who've gone out that have worked for me who have become CIOs, CTOs, CEOs. And I'm very excited about taking this out to a much wider audience. And so that for me, it's like I needed to go through the crucible of actually being in the middle of all these things, extract the things, see the repeating things that happened, and figure out how to take that and make a message. And so for me, it's like I'm now, you know, the messenger of, you know, you can make this work. You can get what you need. You don't have to waste your resources and waste your time. I can help you.
And again, that is the message, and it's not focused on just technology companies. And you're speaking as a company owner, as an entrepreneur, as a father of four children, as a musician, as a music producer. So this is not coming from someone who's just focused on one thing. You've created some amazing businesses in the past.
And well, thank you.
You know, that's the great takeaway, that all the knowledge that you have is just applicable. It is almost like a roadmap for success.
Exactly. I really appreciate that. Thank you. You talked about music, and just very quickly, that's one of the things that I did find, having produced a lot of music that's been on the radio and commercials and done that work, the same principles apply to creating a project for a young band who's disorganized, who wants to get their music out, to be able to get them into the studio and come out with a quality product in a short period of time. Those same principles apply to getting out an MVP.
And yeah, but you know, when we're talking about, you know, bands here, I'm just going to read this slightly. You set up Threshold, which was the former Sony Studios. Yeah. And you write, whilst I was there, we worked with dozens of top acts, such as Green Day, Josh Groban, Franz Ferdinand. You know, so these are not small bands. So you're dealing with some fantastically successful people, and yet everything that you're, it's that same process. So the message is, it doesn't matter what you're trying to do. If you're trying to get a product out there, follow these steps.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we were able to do. And I was very blessed to be able to work with all of the people that produced those various things and worked on all of the different kinds of things that we did for television, music television, for the various labels. It was a blast.
Yes.
But it was, at the same time, it was also very, as you said, for me, it was very enlightening. It's like, oh, these exact, because I almost stumbled on this, but it was very enlightening for me to go through that process and find out all of those things held. That was, I recall the exact conversation. I was bringing something in to be mixed and mastered at Threshold, because they had just gotten started. They had just left Sony.
Yes.
And they wanted to know what I did in my other life. I said, well, you know, you're doing these other things. You've got this great work that you're bringing in here, and you know, it's going to be out there. And I said, and they said, well, what do you do? I said, well, I'm basically a business and technology consultant. I help people get organized and figure out how to do this stuff. And they go, oh my gosh, could you do that for us?
Yes.
And that's what got me, that literally was it. And it was like, well, yes, I can. And all the same things apply. And yes, they did, and we were able to turn the company not only profitable, but to get some major things in there. The big one was the Decades Rock show. If you go and look that up on the internet with VH1, we worked with a ton of really great shows. A number of those became DVDs. One with Bonnie Raitt was a platinum selling DVD. So some really good stuff.
Yes, that's fantastic. But that's again, but it's your ability as an alchemist to sort of shepherd and turn raw talent, raw vision into direction and execution, I think, is it.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, it's an interesting term, alchemist. But yes, the idea is that I do focus on just turning people's ideas into reality.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, David, I mean, I wish we could speak for longer and longer and longer. So it's been absolutely fantastic having you on the show. How do people get hold of you? How do they find out more about what you're doing at Exceed.team? And how do they find out more about you?
Well, the best way to do it is right now is to go to Exceed.team. So EXCEED.TEAM. And there's a website there that talks about what we do, talks about the eight areas that we focus on for various companies to help them figure out where they are. And then you can always email me at david.moss at exceed.team. And I'm happy to work with you and talk with you about anything that you think that would, well, from what we've talked about today, would help your organization to exceed.
Wonderful. That's brilliant. And I'll put all these links. And we mentioned a book by Charles Duhigg. How do we spell that?
D-U-H-I-G-G.
Right. Okay. So I'll put that link on the pages as well, so people can take a look at that book. But David, thanks again. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Matthew, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Wonderful. Well, you've been listening to Hooked on Startups. See you next week. Thank you. Right.